Thank you for joining us for another lesson from God's Word. The West Huntsville Church of Christ at Providence is located at 1519 Old Monrovia Road, Northwest, Huntsville, Alabama, 35806. Anytime you're in the Huntsville area, we hope you'll stop in and be part of our worship. Sunday morning worship is at 9 o'clock, with Bible class immediately following. Sunday evening worship is at 5. Midweek Bible study is held Wednesdays at 7.
Good morning. I hope it won't bother you if I meander around. It's the way I think. appreciate the presence. Appreciate the congregation here having the willingness to host this type of discussion. I think there are a number of things that can get in the way of the church having discussions about mental illness, about mental health. There are a lot of stigmas, right? But one of the main things is just, I think sometimes we don't really know what we're talking about, right? Because the term mental illness is so broad, and there's so many different perspectives, and there's so many different professionals, and so we're just kind of, what exactly are we talking about? So there's two things primarily that I hope to be able for us to accomplish today. The first is to talk about some things that we need to consider in order to understand a little bit more about mental illness. And that may be a little bit more of a boring discussion for some of you, but please bear with me, because it's vital, it's important, it helps us, hopefully will help us sort of bring some order out of the chaos that is depression and anxiety and all of these other labels. And if we can bring a little bit of order out of that chaos, to think about how we might go about making some sense of all of those things, then we can move to putting legs to that, right? Which is the practical aspect of, okay, what do I do when I begin to struggle with depression, anxiety, when these issues come up in my family members? How do I reach out and help the person who's sitting on the pew next to me, who has acknowledged that they're struggling with some mental health issues? And really, how do we create the kind of environment in our congregations where we are comfortable talking with one another about some of these very personal struggles with emotions and with our thinking, right? And so thank you for being here this morning. Thank you for watching the live stream. Thank you for your willingness to come out on a Saturday morning and talk about something like this. As we get started, I want to make sure that we think about a lot of the things that we're going to talk about this morning. Are they're clinical in nature. They come out of a lot of research, a lot of counseling practice, things like that. I'd be glad to share any of those resources with any of you, any of the places you can go to find some of that stuff. But in spite of the fact that's a lot of the information we're sharing this morning, we want to make sure always that it is nestled in the Christian worldview and that it is consistent with what our Bibles teach us, right? And so we're recognizing that this whole conversation has to be nested in the reality that it's our Lord who is the great physician, and that it is our God who gives us power, love, and a sound mind. A sound mind. And so hopefully we, as we have this conversation, and especially as we get into furthering our discussion tomorrow, we sort of bring some of these things all together in a practical and helpful way, consistent with biblical principles and with our Christianity and our commitment to the Word of God. I feel obligated to give a little bit of a disclaimer as we get started too. I am a licensed counselor, which means I've met certain educational qualifications, certain supervision qualifications, passed this wonderful test, all of these things to become a licensed counselor, but I am not your counselor. I don't know anything in particular about your struggles. I don't know anything in particular about your medications, your treatment, your family members. I'm not privy to any of that. And so what we're doing here today is not counseling or treatment of any kind. What we're doing here today is providing you with information. Providing you with information. Now, why do you say that? Well, because we're talking about things that are very personal, but we're not talking about them in a very personal way. And so what I don't want to happen is for us to, for example, if we talked about the idea that many people believe that we're overusing medications to treat some of these things, and medications are overprescribed and overused, right? So if we were to talk about that, please don't leave here going, well, Gary has advised me that I should stop taking my medications, or I should go and tell my family members, hey, you don't have to take antidepressants. Not privy to anyone's particular struggles or issues. And so everything we're talking about very generically. What I would hope, however, is that if you do have a concern about something like that, you now have a little bit more information to go back to your doctor, your treatment team, your counselor, the people involved, right, in working with your family, and you have a little bit more information to have that discussion with them, right? I remember one of the first, my first full-time preaching work, I preached a sermon on Christian joy from the book of Philippians, right? And the first real chewing out that I got was from a very pleasant lady who confronted me about the fact that she was on antidepressants and she was struggling with depression, and how dare I suggest to her that as a Christian she should be joyful. Talking about two different things, right? So it runs both ways. So just a word of caution. Take these things in general. I hope you're able to make some application of them. I hope you're able to take some general principles with you, and that it is productive. But, right, if you need to talk to someone about your specific situation, then that's where your treatment comes from. Don't blame anybody else for what I have to say either, okay? This is on me. But this is a pertinent topic, right? So, you know, one in five, and you can look at all different kinds of websites. There are all kinds of organizations out there that are gathering mental health information, that put statistics out This just happens to come from the National Alliance on Mental Illness. 1 in 5 U.S. adults experience mental illness, and 1 in 20 U.S. adults experience serious mental illness. What's the difference between mental illness and serious mental illness? Well, you know, if somebody else has it, it might not be as serious to you as if you have it, right? But no, serious mental illness speaks to the not a particular diagnosis over another diagnosis. Although there are some diagnoses that typically tend to be more serious. But serious mental illness reflects the severity of the symptoms and the significance of the level of impact on your daily functioning, right? And so, you know, depression and anxiety may be on both sides of that, depending upon the severity of the depression, the debilitating nature of it. So again, that's not speaking to any specific diagnosis, but to the severity of those symptoms. We're going to talk Sunday afternoon about some special considerations for youth, but we're probably going to mention quite a few things that relate to youth throughout this whole thing. That's the population that I actually have most experience working with. 17% of youth ages 6 to 17 experience a mental health disorder. Another thing that you're going to notice is we're going to be using the term mental illness and we're going to be using the term disorder. I prefer the term disorder because the term illness carries with it a number of connotations that aren't necessarily always accurate when it comes to these things that we're talking about. And we'll get into some more of that. But this is why this discussion is pertinent, right? Because there is not a, there's not a person, there's not a family, there's not a congregation of the Lord's church, there's not a community that is not heavily impacted by mental illness, right? We all know somebody. We may be that somebody at some point in our lives. And so this is a very pertinent discussion. It's also a very pertinent discussion considering the spike that occurred in diagnoses of mental illness following the pandemic in 2020. 2020 was a horrible year for a number of things, but for people's mental health especially. There's a one particular, I didn't put this on the slide, but Mental Health America, you can go to their website. They have a report, an annual report of the state of mental health in America. And there's all kinds of data there. But they have screening tools. People can go online there and kind of screen themselves for depression and anxiety. The use of those screening tools during 2020, during the height of pandemic time, increased by 600 to 800%, the use of those screening tools. And not only that, but they saw higher rates of people acknowledging suicidal thoughts and suicidal ideation. And those 70% of the people who did those screenings reported that loneliness and isolation was the top contributing factor to mental health. Right? So what happened was we took the support system right out from under people. And being isolated and unable to go and do the things that they normally did left them without connections, left them without relationships. And at the same time, as their health, as our health began to decline, we also had less access to treatment. Now, we attempted to do a lot through, make treatment accessible through Zoom, right, or video conference kind of treatments. It's not quite the same, But we're talking about, we already had a mental health crisis, and 2020 made that worse. So the chart over here on your right, the right side of the screen, has the 12-month prevalence of any mental illness. So just clump them all together. And there are about 300 in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. Clump them all together, 21% of all adults experience a mental illness or are diagnosed with a mental illness in any 12-month period. And this chart breaks that down by various demographics, and there are any number of reasons why those stats are different for different demographics. The chart on the left side of the screen is the 12-month prevalence of common mental illnesses, and far and away, the leading is anxiety, anxiety disorders. Now, in a minute, we'll run through what some of those anxiety disorders are and what some of their symptoms are. Again, we're trying to understand what mental illness is, right? But 19%. And then second to that is depression. And then dual diagnoses. In other words, it's not just one or the other. And PTSD at 4%. But, you know, this probably doesn't surprise any of you. As we look at the world around us and we think about all of the uncertainty that people experience, and we think about the political climate, and we think about the economic climate, and we think about all of those. Yeah, people are really, really anxious. And it's reflected in mental health. All right, so what are we talking about when we talk about mental illness? We're talking about significant issues in thought, right? Cognition, issues in thinking, emotional, right? So the struggle with always being depressed, or the struggle with the feelings of anxiety, or we're talking about emotional issues. And we're talking about behavioral symptoms, right? Because all of those things function together. Your thoughts affect your emotions, and that affects your behavior, but your emotions affect your thoughts, and right? So there's this interaction of those things. And so these mental illness categories are looking at symptoms of thought, symptoms of emotion, and symptoms of behavior, or a combination of those things. And they are associated with distress. So this subjective feeling of distress, this bothers me, right? This is distressing to me. This causes me a great deal of concern and functional impairment, which means we're talking about something that gets in the way of your relationships being what you want them to be. We're talking about something that gets in the way of work, of your functioning at work. In fact, one of the leading causes of disability worldwide is depression, clinical depression. So we're talking about some level of functional impairment. It's not just that you experience this certain emotion, right? But it is, for this period of time, there's this consistent experience that gets in the way of functioning. On the other side of it, how do we define what mental health is? And what's interesting to me is that even kind of at the beginning, when I began to take the courses I needed to take to learn about counseling and things like that, the vast majority of material that we're looking at, the vast majority of research, the vast majority of the whole discussion actually centers more around illness, actually centers more around people's experience of distress than it ever gets to defining, well what is a healthy mind? What does it mean to be healthy mentally? And while you can go back decades in the discussion around illness, right? You can go back to Freud and Jung and some of those who are attributed with kind of pioneering the whole psychiatry movement and counseling theory and all of that stuff. And everybody's really talking about illness or about disorder, about problems, right? And that kind of makes sense to an extent because it is the distress that everybody's trying to address and deal with. It's easier to see. It's easier to recognize what's problematic and illness, right? But how can we have a really good grasp and understanding of what dysfunction or illness is if we don't have a good understanding and grasp of what health is? And so it's almost as though we've defaulted to mental health is the absence of mental illness. And that's not healthy. That's not exactly right. It's only fairly recently in that whole history and discussion that there's been any kind of intentional, formal effort to really formalize a definition of mental health. Well, what is that definition? Well, the World Health Organization kind of brought some things together to summarize it this way. Mental health is a state of well-being in which an individual realizes his or her own abilities, can cope with the normal stresses of life, can work productively, and is able to make a contribution to his or her community. Kind of almost sounds like just flipping the definition of illness, right? You and I, as Christians, need a seat at the table in this discussion about what mental health is, about what it means to have a healthy mind. And there's not a great consensus in our society, in the medical field, in any of this, about what actually constitutes the ideal way of thinking, way of feeling, right, and way of behaving. And it makes sense to me because if you think about defining mental health, right, yeah, it's easier to recognize illness and dysfunction because you're looking at distress and you're looking at problems, and those tend to pop out. But to begin to discuss what health looks like in the areas of thinking, feeling, and behaving starts to get you into moral territory, doesn't it? Starts to get you in the idea of, well, you know, you should think this way. And you should feel and you should behave this way. So it makes sense to me that the field would shy away from engaging in that discussion. Christians need a seat at that table. We need to be engaging our society about the ideal ways of thinking, feeling, and behaving. I mean, if you look at this, cope with the normal stresses of life, realize his or her own abilities, work productively, able to make contributions to his or her community. We're talking about more than just the mind. We're talking about more than just mental. We've gotten into this habit of dividing categories out, right? So over here is mental health, and over here is physical health, and over here is relational health, and over here is... But that's not how it works. We are very much multifaceted, right? And all of these things come together. And so physical health and spiritual health, they impact your mental health. And your mental health impacts those things too. Because we're talking in part about the ability to understand yourself in a way that allows you to then maneuver through the world and interact and function, right? And so I would encourage you to think about this topic, this discussion, in a broader way. In a broader way than just segregating it out to mental illness. Okay? So I mentioned the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. This is what some have referred to as the Bible of Psychiatry, because this is what you go to, right? This is what the professionals go to in order to look at what symptoms, what dysfunction, what impairment, what distress fits into what category, right? So this is where the diagnosis comes from. So how do people end up with a mental illness diagnosis or a diagnosis of a mental disorder? Well, it comes from the criteria of that book. And it is published by the American Psychiatric Association. Some of the critique of it is that it's too psychiatric in nature and doesn't take some other things into account. It was first published in 1952. It's gone through a number of revisions. This particular version, the newest version, was published in 2013, and it contains about 300 disorders. There's already some work and discussion and process going on about the DSM-5 revised, right? And another revision. So that's kind of interesting for our discussion, because this is a field that's constantly moving and changing. And, you know, just a few years ago, someone may have been diagnosed ADD, ADHD, but now the criteria has shifted, and now it's all ADHD, but it's inattentive type or hyperactive type. So these categories are constantly changing and in flux. Here's what that kind of looks like. So that huge book with all of those disorders, each of those disorders and how they are diagnosed is sort of laid out in this kind of format, right? So if you opened it up to depressive disorders, or you opened it up to anxiety disorders, this is what you're looking at to make that diagnosis. A list of symptoms. You can kind of go down the checklist. Has the person experienced this, 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 or this? And usually it'll say something like, depending upon how many there are, 6 to 8 of these symptoms must be present within such and such a period of time, or for so long, or that kind of thing. And so the way a diagnosis is generally made is through what the patient reports and through a clinical interview, right? So you get that symptom checklist down, and then, of course, the question is, well, do those symptoms cause clinically significant impairment in functioning? Because that's the way we define mental illness, right? Do they cause you significant distress? Do they impair your functioning? So tell me about your work and your ability to function at work. Tell me about your family and your ability to function in your family. Tell me, right? All of those kinds of things. So are there significant symptoms? Do they cause distress and impairment in functioning? And so then we're able to make the diagnosis. As long as it's not better explained by the physiological effects of some kind of substance or drugs, and it's not better explained by one of the other 300 disorders in the book. And there's a ton of symptom overlap. Why do you need to know this? You're not going to be diagnosing anybody. Please don't. So why do you need to know this? Well, here's why I am not super fond of the word illness in the context. I like disorder because that's what we're talking about. We're talking about symptoms that have created or caused disorder. The reason why you need to know this is because we're not talking about things for the vast majority of that book like we talk about COVID or the flu or cancer, where you can go into the doctor's office and they run that swab up to the back of your brain and test it and then say you're positive or negative for COVID, or you're positive or negative for the flu. Or when I take my kids to the pediatrician and they run the swab down their throat and they tell me they're positive or negative for strep throat. That's not how the diagnosis of mental illness works. So there is some critique and some question about, are we really doing the best? Are we really approaching this the best way with such an emphasis on illness and disease talk? Because the reality is that there is very little understanding of some of the mechanisms behind these disorders and illnesses. And if you are curious about that, I can point you to some of that research. And so that is to say that these diagnoses are done through, again, that kind of evaluation. And sometimes that means there is a level of subjectivity that comes in there. Feel free to get a second opinion. Feel free to talk to a different doctor who has a little, or a counselor who has a little bit more experience about some of those differential diagnoses, right? Because it's not a, we swabbed you, we scanned you, we tested this, and yes, they're cancer cells. It's not like that with the vast majority of the disorders in this book. That also means that it doesn't speak to causality. It doesn't speak to causality. So you meet the criteria for depression. You meet the criteria for anxiety. It causes significant impairment, significant distress, and significant dysfunction. And so you get this label of depression, major depressive disorder, or you get this label of one of the anxiety disorders. And people will often then kind of talk about that, and some of us professionals talk about it like that, as, well, you're anxious because you have anxiety. Or you feel depressed because that's what depression does. But that's just categorizing symptoms and impairment. It's not getting to the root. It's not getting to the backdrop of what is causing those depressive symptoms. What is producing your anxiety? You know, it's not like it's this necessarily, like it's like there's this tumor over here or this particular illness here or there. We categorize these symptoms, but this disorder is not, it doesn't speak to the cause of those symptoms. So for example, when I was working at the Children's Advocacy Center, working with child abuse and neglect victims, mostly children, but we would work sometimes with adults who had dealt with abuse or neglect in their childhoods. And quite often, they have a string of diagnoses, right? Depression, anxiety, bipolar, a string of diagnoses. And in our experience of working with them, it's like, okay, well, why? Why were they depressed? Why are they anxious? And it seems that a lot of it has to do with some of those things that they experienced and dealt with or experienced were never really dealt with and never really treated. At Child Haven, we do foster care, and we have, our campus is all teenage girls at the moment. And for a teenage girl to be in the foster system and to be placed in a basic residential program, there is a reason why they're in the foster system. Most of those reasons have to do with histories of abuse and neglect. Physical abuse, sexual abuse, all kinds of things like that. Most of them come with a string of diagnoses and medications. Of course the girl is depressed. Of course the girl is anxious. What other reaction would you expect? The diagnoses don't necessarily get to the causality of the problem. So we have to be able to, and again, why do I need to know this? What's the point here? The point is we can't stop at, here's depression and anxiety, and we can't stop at that. Right? If we're going to really support people and we're going to really get at helping one another, we've got to get to root issues behind, right? I mean, there are good reasons why people are depressed and anxious. In fact, you hear some of the stories that I hear and have heard doing forensic interviews and things, then it actually becomes more surprising that so many people are walking around happy. There's good reason why people are depressed and anxious. So let's talk a little bit about recognizing some of those things. Or you're probably going to hear some of these diagnoses. Maybe a family member, something like that. The anxiety disorders, which we said are the most common, have excessive fear or worry, reaction to stress. Sometimes it's not, you know, sometimes it begins as a decently appropriate reaction, right? So like, yeah, I can understand you being afraid of that. But then it becomes excessive, right? It becomes irrational. It becomes overwhelming, right? So panic disorder is the physiology of anxiety, right? So someone overwhelmed with anxiety has a sudden attack of fear and terror. Sometimes people think they're having a heart attack. There's shortness of breath. There's a pounding heart. There's weakness, dizziness. They feel like they're smothering. And a lot of times, the first time that happens, again, people think there's something seriously wrong. And you know, I mean, there is, but it's not like you're not going to die. It's not like you're having a heart attack or stroke or something like that. And it's a panic attack. And for those to occur frequently is a diagnosis of panic disorder. OCD falls into the anxiety category, obsessive compulsive disorder. And usually this involves frequent and upsetting thoughts where you become obsessed with something and it causes anxiety, and then that gets coupled with the compulsion to do something in order to somewhat alleviate your feeling of anxiety and maybe prevent what you think might happen from happening. I had one really interesting young man that I worked with who, for some reason, had the obsession that at any moment something was going to go horribly wrong for some member of his family. And there was no particular rationale to it, no reason to it. It's just he woke up every day with the dread that today was the day I'll lose my mom, I'll lose my dad, some horrible, terrible accident's going to happen. And the kid would take, you know, 30 minutes to an hour every morning getting ready, and especially tying his shoes. And the compulsion was, if I don't get ready properly, right? And if I don't have my shoes tied just right and properly, then that horrible thing happens. Somehow me not starting the day right is what caused that day to go wrong. Irrational, right? That doesn't make sense. But that's where he was. And so, you know, we explore and try to get to the root of, well, where does that fear come from? And how in the world did you get the shoe thing connected to that, right? But that's the kind of thing that you see in obsessive compulsive disorder. We throw it around a lot. You know, we go, oh, I'm OCD because I got to have my desk just right, or I got to have, that's not what OCD is at all. Social anxiety disorder is exactly what it sounds. Extreme anxiety around others. Sometimes the thoughts that are a part of that are, people are watching me, people are judging me, and so there's this feeling of embarrassment. Most of the time, people aren't paying you any attention, right? But here's the thought process that is problematic, and the emotions that go along with it, and then the behavior, right? The behavior looks like, well, I have trouble functioning then in social settings, which actually only furthers the anxiety because we all need a level of social support. Agoraphobia. Agoraphobia is where we've gotten to such overwhelming anxiety that we're just not even going to leave the house. I just can't. I can't go out there because it's dangerous out there. Specific phobias. If you want something fun to do for the afternoon, just Google phobias, okay? A specific phobia really doesn't have necessarily anything to do with how dangerous a certain thing is. It is just a fearful reaction to it. You could have a phobia of chairs, a phobia of ferns, right? And so there's just almost an infinite list of specific phobias. And then GAD stands for Generalized Anxiety Disorder. And that is just what it sounds. Instead of talking about a specific fear or a specific phobia, or a worry about a specific thing, it's just generalized. I just worry about everything all the time, excessively. And for that to be diagnosed, it's more than, more days than not for at least 6 months, which sounds like a horrible, miserable 6 months. Depression. So, depression is obviously first characterized by depressed mood, right? Sadness, feeling down, sense of hopelessness. Some of the physical things can be changes in appetite, changes in sleep. Quite often there's a countenance that you can tell. Some of the thoughts are, you know, thinking that one is worthless, thinking that one is a sense of shame, a sense of guilt, problems with concentration, problems with making decisions, having no energy, right? Just stay in the bed all of the time. Thoughts of death, thoughts of suicide. Sometimes it's not that someone is suicidal, but they're in such a dark place that there's just these, thoughts of death and dying. I'd be better off dead, or I wish I wasn't born, or something like that. Sunday morning, we're going to look at Job as an example, as we think about how we comfort those who are depressed or in distress. And Job says in Job chapter 3, I wish I hadn't been born. And so, we can kind of understand getting to that level of distress. There are some other diagnoses as well that are quite common. Bipolar is characterized by dramatic mood swings. In my opinion, it is the most misused diagnosis in terms of people self-diagnosing and diagnosing others, right? So someone is, just being in their presence is like a roller coaster of emotion up and down. That's not what bipolar is. Bipolar is sustained periods of depression followed by sustained periods of extreme highs. But it's not like from 1 minute to the next. It's periods. Schizophrenia is characterized by psychotic features, which have to do with hallucinations, seeing things that aren't there, hearing things that aren't there. And PTSD is a very particular reaction to stressors.
We hope you have enjoyed this lesson from God's Word. If you would like to continue your study of New Testament Christianity, please send your name and address to World Bible School, West Huntsville Church of Christ, 1519 Old Monrovia Road Northwest, Huntsville, Alabama, 35806. Or if you prefer, send your name and address by email to wbs@westhuntsville.org.